Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where long-term performance is driven by original, fundamental research on a global scale. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The president himself made the announcement today.
I can report that the necessary steps have been taken to give one of America's most storied automakers, Chrysler, a new lease on life.
Or you could just say bankruptcy. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Monsanto, committed to sustainable agriculture, creating hybrid and biotech seeds designed to increase crop yields and conserve natural resources. Produce more, conservemore.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Thursday, the 30th of April. Great to have you here. You know, the actual bankruptcy petition that Chrysler filed today was a mere 3 pages long. Of course, it was followed by a list of the company's creditors that ran for another 20 or so. Until about this time yesterday, there was some hope in the White House that those creditors would be able to see their way clear to taking less than they were owed, just as a way to keep Chrysler out of Chapter 11. Those negotiations broke down late last night, and so the president found himself at the podium this morning. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale has more now on what the heck happened.
President Obama praised most of the stakeholders, including workers and management, for their concessions. But in the end, about 40 of Chrysler's private debt holders refused to meet government demands. Obama called the holdouts speculators.
They were hoping that everybody else would make sacrifices, and they would have to make none. Some demanded twice the return that other lenders were getting. I don't stand with them.
But the recalcitrant investors defended themselves today. They said they haven't accepted any bailout money, and they're legally bound to protect the interests of their investors. Those include unions, endowments, and retirement plans. James Ellman, who runs the Seacliff Capital hedge fund, not a Chrysler investor, says they are right to stand up to the government.
The maintenance of a domestically owned auto manufacturing capability in the United States is not their concern, and they believe that if they would achieve significantly more in bankruptcy proceedings than in negotiations, these investors are more interested in bankruptcy.
Government negotiators hope the bankruptcy goes quickly, since most of the work has already been done. In the meantime, Obama became salesman in chief.
If you are considering buying a car, I hope it will be an American car. I want to remind you that if you decide to buy a Chrysler, your warranty will be safe because it is backed by the United States government.
Obama then endorsed government incentives for Americans to trade in their old gas guzzlers for cash. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Those 3 pages that it took for Chrysler to get into Chapter 11 leave more questions than they do answers. One of the big ones is, when will Chrysler get out of bankruptcy? Both President Obama and Chrysler executives seem to think it can be done in a month, maybe two. Micheline Maynard covers Detroit for the New York Times. Mickey, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Kai.
How realistic is it that the government thinks this is going to be over with in 30 to 60 days?
Well, Kai, it's not going to go as fast as the government is saying, because we got to look at the Chrysler bankruptcy papers today. And in there, they say that the lawyers plan to present a bankruptcy reorganization plan on August 28th, which is, by my count, about 4 months from now.
Yeah.
And normally the creditors get a chance to respond, so we're at least looking at the fall.
Let me ask you about those creditors, the bondholders that John Dimsdale was talking about in his piece a moment ago. Are they going to be better off having taken a hard line here?
Some of these creditors are secured creditors, and that means that Chrysler's plants and equipment and other operations are actually pledged as collateral for these bonds. And so they can get in front of the judge and say, hi, I'd like to have the Kokomo transmission plant, please. Obviously, they're not going to want to take that home, but I think they believe that they can get a better deal in front of a judge than they could dealing with the Treasury.
What about Chrysler's workers? Are people going to lose their jobs, see their pay cut, those sorts of things?
you know, I've never covered a bankruptcy case where there weren't some job cuts and where there weren't some pay cuts. So, you know, Chrysler is saying no, and the government is saying no, but generally, once you go through one of these cases, you do end up paying people less and employing fewer of them.
Once this is all said and done, the union is going to be the majority stakeholder in this company, the United Auto Workers Union. How equipped are they to actually run a company?
They're probably not going to actually be running the company. What's going to happen is their health care fund, which is called Aviva, will have 55% of the equity in Chrysler, but it will be run by a board of directors. Now, three of the directors will come from Fiat, with which Chrysler is doing an alliance. Five of them will be named by the government. The UAW will get one of those seats, and so the UAW will have input, but it won't be running the company day to day.
You know, the White House has been saying for weeks that what it's trying to do here in these negotiations is prevent the end of the world, this bankruptcy filing. And now today, the president really embraced it. Is it probably the best thing now for Chrysler that it is in bankruptcy?
Well, you know, this is the culmination of years and years and years of overhang for Chrysler. And all the Detroit companies are in the same situation. They have so many dealers, so many liabilities, like things like asbestos lawsuits from over the years, and really going into bankruptcy. If you really want to get rid of that stuff, it's the only way to do it. So even though Chrysler's problems accelerated because of the credit crunch, the housing slump, et cetera, this is something that's been in the making literally for decades.
And what about, finally, Mickey, General Motors? They've got another month. What does this mean for them?
You know, this is going to give the government a look at what it's like to run a bankruptcy case with a major automaker. And if someone said to me that this is a good way to get free information, I said, well, it's costing the government $8 billion to get this information. But it could be a preview of the larger General Motors case that's to come. And if this turns ugly, you know, we might see more efforts to restructure General Motors out of court. Conversely, if it goes pretty smoothly, you know, the path could be laid for GM to end up in Chapter 11 as well.
Micheline Maynard is a senior business correspondent for the New York Times. She covers Detroit. Mickey, thanks a bunch.
It's always my pleasure, Kai.
GM was a winner today on Wall Street. Shares rose 6%. Otherwise, a mixed bag. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. For all the billions of dollars the internet has delivered to those who've unlocked its secrets, for a lot of the big entertainment companies, the web hasn't quite lived up to its financial promise. But that hasn't stopped them from trying. Today, Disney said it's going to buy a 30% stake in Hulu.com. That's a video streaming site now owned by NBC and Viacom. Disney, which owns ABC, is going to put its movies and full-length television episodes on Hulu to let consumers watch them for free, provided they don't mind putting up with some ads. Marketplace's Jennifer Collins has more.
During the Super Bowl this year, actor Alec Baldwin introduced millions of Americans to this one-stop shop for video online.
Hulu beams TV directly to your portable computing devices, giving you more of the cerebral, gelatinizing shows you want anytime, anywhere, for free.
And it seems Americans have tuned into that cerebral, gelatinizing stuff. Last month, Hulu.com showed 340 million videos from network TV, cable, and others. That makes Hulu the number two video site behind YouTube. Ann Sweeney heads up Disney's television operations, which include ABC.
They became someone that we wanted to be in business with.
She says the hope is Disney will bring viewers to Hulu, and Hulu will bring viewers to Disney.
Because there's not a lot of crossover, and we want to tap into those casual viewers.
The deal could drive TV watchers to Hulu for shows like Grey's Anatomy and Lost. NBC and Fox already have shows on the site. Mark Hughes follows online advertising as the CEO of Buzz Marketing.
I actually think it is very smart to get all your kind of major content in one spot.
He says Hulu could become a mecca for advertisers. Online viewers can't skip the commercials, and media forecaster IPG expects a more than 30% growth in online video advertising this year. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
While a lot of attention has been focused on bailouts and bank earnings, things that used to be news still are. Iraqi officials are meeting with international business executives in London today, about 250 of them, companies from Shell Oil to Rolls-Royce. They'll be talking about possible investment opportunities as Baghdad takes on more responsibility for security and rebuilding. As it stands right now, most of the money for that rebuilding comes from the United States. Stuart Bowen is the Special Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction. His office has just put out its most recent quarterly update. Good to talk to you again.
Thanks, Kai. It's good to be with you again.
Where are we having the most success with what we're spending?
I think that it's evident now that the Iraqi army has substantially improved its capability over the last 2 years. That directly stems from the investment of $18 billion in U.S. taxpayer money through the Iraq Security Forces Fund. That's paying off, but it will really need to pay off this spring. The last 10 days have been the bloodiest 10 days in Iraq for 18 months.
Yeah, I want to pick up on a couple of things you said in that regard. You call it a changing security posture. The other way to say that is the withdrawal of troops. How is that going to affect reconstruction and what we're spending?
Well, it will directly affect reconstruction because it means that the provincial reconstruction teams will have less capacity, less ability to move about the country. Right now, they are fairly free to operate where U.S. forces control in the provinces. That's going to change rather quickly over the next year, and that means the Provincial Reconstruction Team program will begin to wind down.
The Iraqi government gets a lot of its revenue from oil, and yet you write that there is still no oil law there. How can that be?
Well, we've written that every quarter now for 2.5 years, and it is, I think, a serious sticking point with regard to overall progress for Iraqis. That means that they don't have rules of the game for multinationals to invest. Prime Minister Maliki told me when I visited with him in February that he's very upset with the Kurdish regional government selling oil directly on the open market from the Kirkuk fields, a very, very serious issue, I might add, in 2009 for Iraq, that is the Kurdish-Arab tensions.
Is American support still necessary at its present levels?
Yes, for three reasons. One, to try and facilitate reconciliation between the Sons of Iraq, the Sunnis whom we employed in the security apparatus as they transitioned to government of Iraq control. Two, to help the Iraqis resolve the Kurdish-Arab tensions, which continue to arise. And three, to provide capacity building for the national government and the local government, particularly in light of the financial difficulties the country now faces because of the collapse in world oil prices.
Is your job made easier or more difficult by the fact that Iraq is not really on the front pages over here very much anymore?
I think it's irrelevant to my mission. My mission is about being the taxpayer's watchdog in Iraq.
What about the job of reconstruction, though?
Well, there is now under $7 billion left to spend, well under $1 billion in new money that will be appropriated for Iraq, and that is as it should be. Iraq has the third largest oil reserves in the world. The duty of reconstruction, capital R, is the duty of the government of Iraq.
Stuart Bowen is the Special Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction. Mr. Bowen, thanks so much for your time.
Good. Thank you, Kai.
Coming up, an old song with a modern message.
I think it's geared towards increasing an awareness of what sometimes people miss when they're being preyed upon.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials lost 17 points today, just 0.2%, ended at 8,168. The NASDAQ, meantime, found positive territory, picked up 5 points, 0.3%, wrapped up the day at 1717. The S&P 500 followed the Dow down, shed a fraction of 1 point, 0.1%, finished at 872. A better-than-expected earnings report from OfficeMax helped lift investor spirits. Shares of the Cubicle Outfitter rose nearly 24% today. Similar earnings reports helped boost Dow Chemical more than 18%, International Paper more than 16%, cereal maker Kellogg's more than 6%. But there was a flip side, too. Poor earnings and news that it's scrapping its dividend helped drain the color out of Eastman Kodak. The stock fell more than 16% today. Bonds fell, too. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.12%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. Keep an eye on Marketplace wherever you go. iPhone users can listen to business news and updates on fallout from the financial crisis, watch the Marketplace whiteboards, and follow the Scratchpad blog. Just visit marketplace.org on your iPhone.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on factory orders for March. A House Subcommittee on Communications Technology and the Internet holds a hearing on cybersecurity. The agenda includes threats to communication networks and power grids. And Got Fence? In La Crosse, Kansas, home of the Kansas Barbed Wire Museum, the annual Antique and Barbed Wire Swap and Sell gets underway. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Everybody here at Marketplace got an email from Human Resources the other day. What to do to keep swine flu at bay? Cover our mouths when we cough, wash our hands a lot, and stay home if we're sick. The president said the same thing during his news conference last night. And a lot of companies have contingency plans in case things get worse. But for some employees, that staying home part could be tricky. From New York, Ashley Montite reports.
Forget first stage stuff like mandates on washing hands and avoiding your hacking colleagues. Ken McGee of Gartner Research says companies' biggest responsibility is to ensure their most important employees are equipped to work from home. He says that means installing backup internet broadband.
Because home networks are not designed to carry the kind of traffic burden that would be presented by masses of people having to work from their homes. I mean, this is just not another snow day.
Bill White of Sprint Nextel's communications department says Sprint already has those backup plans in place and a few more.
No travel to Mexico. We also are looking at other travel restrictions possibly to be put in place. So if we have a large meeting scheduled, we're looking at whether or not we need to cancel that or postpone it or find an alternative way of conducting the meeting so it's not in person.
White says Sprint employees will be able to take time off to look after sick kids and not be penalized. But a lot of workers won't have that option. Ellen Galinsky of the Families and Work Institute says only 47% of employers allow people paid time off to take care of sick children.
And if you're low income, it's just about one in four of you who has access to paid sick time.
She says you may be able to thrash out a marketing plan from home, but you can't make a hotel bed unless you're there. Still, she had a conference call today with 30 big employers, a hotel group among them. All agreed that being flexible was the only way to get through the flu. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tight for Marketplace.
Among those holding a little more tightly to their checkbooks in this recession is a group of people whose job it is to spend money. Venture capitalists aren't venturing quite as much as they used to. Investment in biotech, for just one example, is down by roughly half since the beginning of last year. One sector is holding its own, though. It's even up a little bit. Healthcare information technology, all the software and management systems that keep doctors' offices and hospitals humming along. From the Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk at Oregon Public Broadcasting, Mitchell Hartman reports.
Until recently, when venture capitalists put money into medicine, they went after the hot stuff, cutting-edge drugs and heroic surgeries using space-age medical devices.
Funding those things used to be a no-brainer because people wanted to live for an extra 6 months or an extra year.
Dr. Seth Rudnick heads up healthcare investment at Canaan Partners, a Silicon Valley venture capital firm. In the past decade, biotech and medical device companies routinely sucked up $1 to $2 billion every quarter. After all, drugs to fight cancer and pacemakers to keep hearts beating are expensive to develop and deploy.
Suddenly, maybe that's not going to be cost efficient, so you may shift your funding to those things that change how long people live healthy lives.
We all of a sudden have to focus on the routine care of chronic conditions early rather than the life-saving, really glamorous, glitzy treatment of acute conditions after they've progressed.
Scott Wallace is a fellow at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business. He used to head the National Alliance for Health Information Technology. He says investment dollars are following the government's new reform agenda to control costs by promoting the most efficient, cost-effective treatments, which in turn hangs on putting more patient data online than using it to coordinate care. Take, for example, one of the most pervasive conditions, says Wallace, diabetes.
In the patient's home, the patient takes a blood sugar reading. The patient steps on a scale. They can use a blood pressure cuff that is connected to their computer, and somebody in a caregiver's office can look at that data and can say, wow, this patient is trending toward a problem. We need to intervene in this really early.
But Wallace says we're not anywhere near there yet.
The systems to support that don't really exist. And there's an enormous opportunity and now an enormous incentive to put those kinds of systems into place.
Including $19 billion in the Obama stimulus package to encourage doctors to get up to speed using electronic medical records.
Healthcare IT is a good place to be right now from a fundraising point of view.
That's Louis Machuca, CEO of medical software company Cryptic in Portland. Cryptic's software securely connects medical offices online. It allows medical staff to use and share electronic patient records, charts, CAT scans, and the like, 24/7.
So that point of efficiency, although it's very pedestrian and perhaps not as glamorous as the next new breakthrough drug, really is what stands between us and a better healthcare system.
Cryptic has been growing 20% to 40% a year. Machuca says his phone's been ringing off the hook since the president announced his digital medicine incentive plan. It doesn't hurt that doctors and hospitals face penalties if they don't take the bait. DrChrono.com is another company moving into this space. The two-person New York startup offers web-based appointment scheduling for small doctor's offices. It launched in January, and co-founder Daniel Kivitanos says they'll introduce their latest software package in June.
One of our future goals is to have a billing system that electronic medical record systems can just kind of connect into us and use us as a billing component.
Rocket science, maybe it's not, but that's really not the name of the game anymore. Used to be the hottest medical startups were chasing hit-or-miss miracle drugs and treatments. Nowadays, they're more likely to be like Cryptic and Dr. Chrono, painstakingly tying up the electronic loose ends of our tangled healthcare system, saving a little money and perhaps a few lives in the process. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Seventy years ago, as the economy was finally crawling out of the Great Depression, banks in this country were just about as unpopular as they are today. Singer Woody Guthrie tried to tap into a little bit of that discontent.
I'm a jolly banker, or the banker's lament. You can call it either one you want to.
Fast forward to the present day, and what Guthrie said back then rings just as true.
When dust storms are sailing and crops they are failing, I'm a jolly banker am I.
Woody Guthrie's body of work about the troubles of people living through hard times inspired a lot of artists. Most recently, the band Wilco. They're out with a new cover of Jolly Banker tomorrow. And I sat down the other day with frontman Jeff Tweedy. What prompted you to pull this song out of the archives and do it? I mean, was it the obvious thing, the news of the day?
It was Nora, his daughter, Nora Guthrie, who runs the archives a couple of months ago when things really started to get hairy financially and economically for the country, and that song had begun to get a little bit of attention, and she felt like somebody was going to cover it, and she called us because she wanted it to be us.
When money you're needing and mouths you are feeding, I'm jolly banker am I.
It is fundamentally a protest song.
Yeah, I think it's geared towards increasing an awareness of what sometimes people miss when they're being preyed upon. Sometimes people don't seem to be able to get that because they're blinded by their desire to have the new car or whatever.
Just bring me back two for the one I lend you, singing I'm a jolly banker, jolly banker.
Are you hearing any of that same social commentary in the music that's out there today, the stuff you listen to or the stuff you guys do?
I don't think so. I don't hear anything as direct as the type of stuff that Woody did. I don't know. It's a very different time. There's an aimless quality to a lot of protest that I hear these days. Maybe history provides a sense of black and white, but it doesn't seem to be as easily defined these days.
On that topic of social commentary, though, I mean, you guys have a concert DVD coming out. It's called Ashes of American Flags. What's the point there?
Traveling around the country, I think one of the things that occurred to us in as a way to make a concert film have a little bit more weight than just being a concert film, we came up with the idea of documenting some of our favorite venues and some of the places that we get to see by traveling around America that feel like the best parts of America, at least the best parts of what we thought of as America when we were growing up. There's places like Kane's Ballroom in Tulsa, Oklahoma, Ryman Auditorium in Nashville, Tipitina's in New Orleans, and just very unique places that have a real regional flavor to them.
That open road part is exactly what Woody Guthrie did. He spent miles and miles and years on the roads of this country. What would he think today if he went out there and did what he did 40, 50, 60 years ago? What kinds of songs would he write?
Well, going through the archives, one of the things that struck me is that Woody wrote about everything. And so answering a question like that is almost impossible because he's very famous for writing about the Dust Bowl ballads and kind of documenting the struggles of that group of people. But to answer your question, what would Woody write about now? Everything. he would I'm sure that some of the stuff we were just talking about would strike him. The fact that everywhere he went looked a little bit more alike than it did when he was traveling around the country. I noticed that even from the 20 years that I've been on the road. There are places that used to feel like you were in a unique place in the world and in a place that was different from the last place you were, and it doesn't feel as much like that these days.
Jeff Tweedy from the rock band Wilco. Jeff, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Proceeds from Wilco's version of Jolly Banker go to the Woody Guthrie Foundation and Archives. We've got both versions of the song, his and Wilco's, on our homepage. It's marketplace.org.
My name is Tom Cranker, and I'm a jolly banker. I'm a jolly banker am I. I safeguard the farmers and widows and orphans, singing I'm a jolly banker am I.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering absolute return funds with goals designed to match yours. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, proof that marketing and branding do indeed work. The World Health Organization has seen the light as provided by the global hog raising industry. The WHO announced today that it's officially not swine flu anymore. Instead, the proper terminology is influenza A H1N1. The agency did say it hopes the change will have some practical effects, like helping convince governments that there's nothing to fear from live hogs and from pork imports. That is Marketplace from American Public Media this Thursday afternoon. Today, the Dow fell 17 points, 0.2%. The Nasdaq rose 5 points there, 0.3%. The S&P 500 lost a fraction of 0.1%. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Phyllis Owens, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Coming up next time on the program, trouble at home touches those working abroad.
The day before we were to sign for our lease, my boss called from the U.S. and said, don't sign that lease because we don't know what's going on.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.